Global Capital Podcasts.
Hello and welcome to the Global Capital Podcast. I'm Ralph Sinclair and I'm the London Bureau Chief at Global Capital.
And I'm John Hay, the Corporate Finance and Sustainability Editor.
Every week, this is your first port of call for all that's most interesting in capital markets. And coming up this week, we'll be talking with our Corporate Bond Editor, Mike Turner, about a story he's written with you, John, about the what might be a coming-of-age moment for sustainability-linked bonds. And then we have a podcast debutant, our new Corporate Loans Reporter, Anna Fatty, will be joining us to talk about a new twist on corporate lending. And in a minute, we're going to be talking about Israel and a spate of bond issuance it's been doing at a very interesting time, obviously. But first, we've got an exciting event coming up to talk about, haven't we?
Yes, GC Live. Global Capital is launching a series of events, live events, that will be held in the morning in different places. And they're sort of small events open to trialists and subscribers, where we'll have discussions about key topics that are important to the capital markets at the moment. And it's going to be very much editorially led and, you know, incisive discussion about what market practitioners really think.
Yeah, when we say trialists and subscribers, we do, of course, mean to Global Capital, not the podcast. So if you want to stand a chance of going, you need to take out either a trial to Global Capital over at the website, that's free, or subscribe, which isn't, but is, of course, great value. Now, the first one is going to be on UK bank capital. And that's been, you know, it's been quite the year for bank capital, hasn't it?
Well, yes, we've had a major bank fail in Credit Suisse, which hasn't happened for a long time. And it's obviously put the whole bank capital system under trial. You know, banks have issued all kinds of tiers of capital in a way that's coordinated with the regulators in order to strengthen their balance sheets and supposedly create firewalls and protections and sort of levers that they can use when they get into trouble. And the Credit Suisse situation is obviously a case where this was used. And you know, we were talking last week about how the additional tier one capital layer of Credit Suisse was wiped out, to the great anger of many investors. But I think it's really an opportunity to think about you know, whether the system works well, what happens when a bank is in difficulty. And you know, we'll be discussing these issues in a UK context.
Yeah, that's right. We'll be in the room with some of the UK's most senior bank treasurers and funding officials to discuss all this, and investors. We'll be talking about whether the regime works as it is supposed to, whether these sort of different strata of bank capital actually work, or whether anything needs changing. And of course, the clincher is, I mean, although one of the sessions will be published on Global Capital later on for subscribers to look at, the rest of the event is, of course, off the record. So the only way you can find out what gets said is to be there.
So be there. And that's on the morning of December the 13th, the Wednesday.
Now, to this week's news, and a really interesting story by our emerging markets team of George Collard and Francesca Young, and our bank finance editor, Atanas Dinov, who have been uncovering a series of bond issues by Israel that they've priced since the Hamas attacks on October the 7th.
So, Ralph, Israel has issued about $5 billion of this debt, our reporters have discovered. But it's not normal bonds, is it? It's not a sort of big public bond issue.
No, that's right. Typically, Israel comes to the public bond market in January and it does one or two deals. They usually raise €1 billion, something like that, $1 billion, something in that kind of region. And this year, we found these sort of what we tend to term, you know, ambiguously in the capital markets, private placements, MTNs, medium-term notes, club deals. But basically, the typical approach that Israel has taken over the years to do a syndicated public deal. So it's all over screens. Everyone gets to buy it. And there's a number of banks involved. Usually three banks are involved in arranging the sale. These deals, as you say, John, they've raised about $4.5 billion so far. But three of the deals came this week, so this is very much ongoing activity. Each deal was arranged by just one bank, Those banks are all part of Israel's primary dealer group, so the group that's most active in trading and bringing its sovereign bonds to market. And it's across a range of currencies and maturities.
So what sort of bonds are they, Ralph, and which banks have been leading them?
Well, we've had a little route around, and the first example we can find, now obviously this deal is from September the 28th, so before the Hamas attacks even, but in that instance, BNP Paribas did a 20 billion yen issue for Israel. Then the rest of the deals that we've found have all happened since October the 25th. And those are a series of new bonds and then increases to those bonds done in euros and dollars. And the banks involved in doing them so far have been Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, Barclays and Bank of America.
So why do you think Israel would come to the market privately? If it needs money, as might be inferred, for the war effort, why not do a public bond?
There could be a number of reasons. Firstly, it may want to raise extra money to fund the war effort. Secondly, it may be raising money given the likely economic downturn it's going to suffer from being involved in a war. Capital Economics, a sort of economic research company, thinks that GDP growth in Israel will be 3% this year, and that's down from 3.3%, which it previously forecast. So it could be funding sort of, you know, saving up for a rainy day. Israel, of course, has conscription into its defence force. And so that will take a lot of people out of the labour force if they're busy involved in the fighting. And of course, the other reason is, well, we mentioned that public deal that Israel typically does in January. There are some thoughts that it might have done this funding to preempt having to come at all in January. Now, of course, Israel is usually it's quite a unique sort of credit in the emerging markets. It's very well rated, and it doesn't have the typical emerging market bond audience that other countries have. It has a very sort of dedicated and loyal following in different parts of the world, particularly in the US. And they tend to be the ones that support these issues. However, a country that is suddenly at war having to bring a public bond to the market is likely to find the market is a little bit less receptive than normal and will demand a higher interest rate. And that's certainly one school of thought, that this is prudent debt management on Israel's part.
In other words, to avoid sort of a big splashy deal where they might have to pay up a bit, and, you know, which sort of has an effect on debt management. If you do one cheap deal, it sort of tends to widen the other bonds and, you know, perhaps affect the cost of funds in future. The more astute way is perhaps to do these deals privately and break off bits of the funding at yields that the market doesn't see.
Exactly right. And when that's your one big banner capital markets event of the year, there's obviously an awful lot of attention paid to it.
So do we know anything about who's investing in these deals?
Not specifically. And it's very interesting. And the reason why we included the yen bond that was initially placed in September was because, well, Japanese investors are usually very risk averse to something where there might be a sort of whiff of geopolitical tension or other risk. And that bond was subsequently tapped later on. So it all adds to a very sort of interesting sort of question about who's actually buying it. Now, although we don't know the identity of anyone who's bought any of these bonds, what Israel did say in early November was that the Development Corporation for Israel has raised more than $200 million, mostly from states, institutions and local authorities in the US. Now, it's unclear whether any of that money was put to work in primary or secondary bond markets specifically. And of course, you know, if they bought bonds in the secondary market, then no money actually goes to the issuer. But Pennsylvania, Florida, Illinois, New York, Texas, Ohio, they're all states that have purchased Israel bonds. And Palm Beach County, the city of Miami Beach and Cross River Bank have also done so.
And Israel also has an organization called the Israel Bonds Organization, which does, and, you know, for a long time has helped it raise money. The finance ministry put out a statement on October the 16th saying that over the years, in normal and emergency times, the Israel Bonds Organization has been an important pillar in financing the state of Israel. And, you know, they're saying that there's high demand for their debt. There's confidence in the country and in the economy. So it's obviously a statement that, you know, we can raise money, and, you know, we're going to do so.
Now, an important thing to note, of course, that this, while we've already said that this might be as an alternative to bringing a public deal in January, people in the market really don't think that's necessary, even. Plenty of emerging market syndicate bankers think Israel could do a public bond as soon as it wanted to. And certainly from a debt metric perspective, there are far worse cases in the emerging markets than Israel. And that is ultimately what bond investors care about, whether they're going to get paid back or not. As one of those bankers told us this week, it's still a good credit and it's open for business and they might want to show that off. So it's certainly not a case that the public deal in January won't happen.
Yeah, it might well happen. And if you think about if the financing they've been doing recently is sort of extra, you know, for extra needs, then, you know, it's likely that they would presumably do the regular deal as well.
Indeed.
Well, we'll keep you posted at Global Capital on this story as it develops.
And in the meantime, we're joined by Mike Turner and Anna Fatty to talk about some recent twists in corporate lending. Good morning, Mike. Welcome back to the podcast. And good morning, Anna, and welcome to your podcast debut.
Good morning.
Good morning.
First thing we're going to talk about then today, Mike, is yours and John's story about the sustainability-linked bond market. It's possibly coming of age in the very near future. Tell us, first of all, we used to talk about sustainability-linked bonds all the time on the podcast, but we haven't talked about them in a while. So let's have a quick recap of what one is.
Sure. So they came about, they were invented in 2019 by an Italian company called Enel and got really popular in 2021. And basically what they are is a way for a company to raise ESG-linked debt, environmental, social and governance-linked debt, but do it in a way where the use of proceeds, they can spend the money that they raise on whatever they want. But to do that, they promise to hit targets. And, you know, generally it's a sustainability target. It'll be something along the lines of cutting greenhouse gas emissions over a certain period of time. And then if they don't hit that target on the date that it's tested, the coupon will go up by a certain amount.
Right. Okay. And they've come in for quite a bit of stick this year, as you've reported at length. Why is that, and what has that meant for issuance volumes?
Yeah. So it's their main competitor, I suppose, in the ESG market is a green bond. And with a green bond, there's a very direct line between you raise X amount of money, and then that gets spent on a green project, on something that's been approved as a green project, like a wind farm, for example. Whereas with SLBs, it's a bit more opaque in that the money can be spent on anything, and investors have to accept that the targets that are given are a stretch and will make a meaningful difference to the company's sort of carbon emission output or whatever it is they're focusing on an ESG focus. After the big burst of deals in 2021, investors started worrying that companies weren't being anywhere near ambitious enough. And essentially they were trying to, pull one over a bit on investors by saying that they're doing this ESG stuff, but really they're not. It's just their sort of normal course of business they'd be doing anyway.
Greenwashing, in other words.
Greenwashing, yeah, exactly. And that made them fall quite sharply out of favour among investors.
So after a massive expansion in 2021, issuance actually fell for the last 2 years. There was 84 billion euros issued in 2021, 67 billion the next, and only 49 billion this year. And it's been shrinking most markedly in its actual home market, which is European corporate bonds, which are now only about half the issuance, having been 60%. So there does seem to be a bit of a sort of lack of trust in the product or lack of enthusiasm for it, perhaps, over some of the last 2 years.
Right, but we are still seeing companies bring their debut SLBs, aren't we? It's not completely dead in the water or anything like that.
That's right. And, some very high-profile companies have joined the market. We've had companies like Ferrovial, the infrastructure group from Spain, Heathrow Airport, Orange, the telecoms company, and other companies doing repeat deals, which shows that they really like the product, including Carrefour, the French supermarket chain, and Eni, the Italian oil company. So there's good support for the product in the corporate sector, I think. And, you know, the fact that that's been resilient is significant. What the problem is more on the investor side.
Well, tell us a bit more about that, Mike. What's give us a bit more detail. I mean, we've said that they are worried about sort of standards and greenwashing and the credibility of the product. Give us a bit of a flavour of what they've said in more detail.
Yeah, so that, I mean, that can't be underestimated. People do, investors really do think that, have a distrust of it, particularly when you compare it to green bonds, which is just so much more simple. An investor told me, head of fixed income at an asset manager, told me that it just feels a bit like PR for the companies at the moment. And, you know, whether that's true or not, and whether companies are setting ambitious targets or not, the fact that that mindset exists in a head of fixed income somewhere, you know, shows that there's a distrust of how ambitious these targets are. The other issue is the penalty that companies have to pay if they miss their targets. So this, because of the time period when this came about, 2021, the European Central Bank was still buying loads of bonds, so coupons were still incredibly low. And the sort of market agreed penalty was 25 basis points step up if you screw up and don't hit what you need to. The problem with that is now coupons are, you know, 4%, 5%, 6%, so 25 basis points doesn't move the needle, doesn't make any difference. So, you know, from a purely monetary point of view, investors also feel like they're getting shortchanged there.
Yeah, it's surprising no one thought at the time that interest rates might go back up. But anyway, we'll come to that.
Anyone thought that at the time, did they? It's going to last forever.
they certainly weren't interested in engaging with the topic anyway, that's for sure. Right, so you've mentioned Enel, the Italian energy company that first brought this product to the market. Now, they're about to miss, or we think they might be about to miss, targets on their KPIs and their SLBs. That might actually be quite good for the market, mightn't it?
Yeah, I think it'll be great for the market, because this goes directly against investors complaining that targets aren't ambitious enough. If targets are being missed, then clearly they were ambitious or over-ambitious. So I mean, it's gonna be terrible for Enel, because they've got 10 billion plus euros of bonds with coupons that are stepping up. But for a wider market perspective, it's very, very difficult for an investor to say that Enel hasn't pushed hard enough on what they're trying to achieve.
John, you've written about these NL bonds recently quite a lot. What has the market reaction been to the fact that NL might be missing a target and therefore having to pay more interest on its bonds?
Yeah, it's very interesting, actually. First of all, we should say that we don't know yet that they will miss the target. That we won't know that till after the 31st of December, when NL will disclose what its result for 2023 was in terms of reducing the emissions intensity of its power generation business. But the people who studied the evidence, which includes, you know, basically what Enel have reported so far on how it's getting on, notably a think tank called the Anthropocene Fixed Income Institute, reckon that it's going to be very difficult for them to hit the target. For one thing, it's an average over the year. So even if their performance sort of massively improves at the end of the year, you know, there's an enormous amount of catching up to do, basically. One of the interesting things is it's partly because of factors outside their control. The war in Ukraine happened, and the Italian government told Enel, among other power companies, to keep some coal power stations going longer than they would have planned. And you know, that's the sort of real world event that can derail companies in their attempts to decarbonize. Now, the way the market's reacted is odd, because the Anthropocene Fixed Income Institute noticed that the bonds were trading as if this step up wasn't going to happen, and that could have been a number of reasons. For example, the market didn't think it was going to happen or hadn't noticed that it might. But anyway, after their report, the bonds did shift, not immediately, but over a couple of weeks. And now they're trading more as if the market expects the step up to happen.
Okay, so how does that leave us then in terms of the SLB market as a whole? Have investors said they're more encouraged by the fact that perhaps these targets aren't quite so easily achievable? Or do we think this is just a bit of an anomaly in NL's case?
Well, none of the investors that I've spoken to are particularly keen on SLBs. So I think it's still got some way to go. But it's still a very nascent market and still very new. So there are standards that are still being found. And NL isn't the only company to have, or potentially to have, missed its targets as well. There's a Greek utility, PPC, and there is in Poland a company called Orlen. And they've both missed their targets already. So it's a thing that's happened. It's not a completely new precedent for the market. But it feels like there was so much exuberance in 2021. And I've said this before in this podcast, but I think it bears repeating, that I distinctly remember bankers telling me they were calling up clients and just saying, just whack sustainability linked on anything you got and we'll put it out there and it'll be bought. And that, you know, that doesn't necessarily lead to a healthy standardized market. So I think we're just seeing the payoff of that. But it's still, you know, if these coupon step ups happen and the companies pay them and, you know, the investors get what they were contractually obliged to get, then that's the makings of a solid market, I think.
Okay. The other issue we've already raised, or problem we've already raised, is that the step ups themselves aren't really that material. I say material, what I mean is impressive when interest rates have gone up. Are there any sort of ideas floating around for how to make them more, I don't know, relevant or more of a stick to hold borrowers to account with?
Well, I think one of the interesting things about the NL situation, which we looked at yesterday, is that the bonds are not all the same maturity. Now, all of them are, all of these 10 billion, that is about 40% of NL's total of sustainability-linked bonds, because they've got a lot of others, are going to be tested on the 31st of December, and their coupons will go up by 25 basis points next year if the test is missed. Now, some of those bonds last until 2025, but some go much longer out to, I think, 2031 on the longest one. So NL will be paying that step-up coupon for a long time, and that means it's going to cost them a lot more. And this is an aspect that the market has really not paid much attention to up to now. No one really expected the step-up coupon to be triggered. You know, the company always expects to hit its targets, and, you know, normally they do. People haven't really sort of thought about the difference between a bond where the step-up's going to last for a year and a half and one where it's going to last for 6 years. And that ought really to be priced in somehow. And there's only a very few people who've really thought about this issue. And I think they've made a good case. And I'm thinking again of this institute, that there ought to be some kind of standardized way of calculating the step up.
It's interesting you say that, John, because Heidelberg Materials did a deal this week, an SLB, which there was two targets linked to it. And the first one is going to be tested in 2026, and the deal matures in 2033. And if they miss it, then the coupon will step up in 15 basis points increments from then. So there's definitely, to me at least, it feels like issuers and their syndicate banks who help put these deals together, there's more of a recognition that that moving this testing date so the coupon has longer to step up for is a viable way to get investors on board.
Yeah, that was a really interesting one as well, because it's the first one I've seen where there are two test dates on the same indicator. Sometimes you get them on different indicators, like the company's trying to both reduce carbon emissions and improve gender diversity or something like that. But to have them on the same indicator but at different points in time is, you know, that's done in the loan market a lot, but we haven't seen that in the bond market. I think that is a good reflection of the way companies are going through transition over time.
For sure. And I also think that helps quell one of the other complaints I hear quite often about SLBs, that the testing date is so far off, or you know, that so much can happen in the time between the bond being printed and the testing date. So having an earlier testing date helps that, you know, helps investors feel like they've made the right decision.
But there is another issue to raise there, which is, and here the Heidelberg structure is clever because it addresses this as well. But if, you know, one concern investors have is that, you know, let's say the target date is passed, and whether the company hits it or not, it's then happened. Now, that bond no longer has any kind of incentive for the company. The step up has either happened or not and is in the past. So, you know, should that really be considered a sustainable finance instrument anymore? Now, you know, personally, I think this is a bit sort of fussy and nitpicky, but, you know, there are definitely investors who are concerned about that issue. And, you know, so if the market's to evolve to having the test dates earlier, that, you know, helps in one way, but it kind of creates more of the back end problem with the bond being sort of spent at the end. And, you know, I think the Heidelberg structure sort of cleverly addresses that.
What about, though, taking this NL example? Now, let's assume there's no disputing the fact that NL is only going to miss this particular target because of an unforeseen global event. And then it was instructed by the government to do something. So it has no real choice but to miss its target. That's kind of a problem, isn't it? Because that's not really what the SLBs were intended to penalise issuers for. Should NL try and sort of wheedle its way out of paying a step up?
Well, no, because, you know, it can't. I mean, even if it was the case that the government completely controlled NL, which it doesn't, you know, there are still other things it could have done. I mean, it's sort of within the realms of business normality. You know, the government threw this thing in their path that they couldn't do anything about. But, you know, theoretically, they could have closed other capacity or sold it, or, you know, they could have got around it somehow. But the point is, you know, your bigger point is, should companies wriggle out? And I think, you know, emphatically not. I mean, if they start to do that, the market will die.
Yeah, well, I agree. The market will die instantly, I think.
Of course, the trouble is, the more meaningful step-ups they have to pay on missed targets, the less money they can spend on actually greening themselves, because they're spending it all on debt interest.
It's not very much. You know, I mean, that, to Mike's point about the step-ups not being enormous, I mean, we calculated that it might be about 96 million euros for if NL left all of these bonds outstanding and they did step up until maturity. But that's spread over 5 or 6 years, and it's an enormous company with 89 billion euros of total debt. So, you know, this amounts of money are not going to affect any company's operational capacities.
Although what this might do, actually, that a point there is that the high yield sector is one sector that is suggested might be a heavier user of SLBs in the future, because you know, they need to transition just as much as every other company does under various government mandates to green economies. But they can't really do green bonds because they, in many cases, they're not big enough to have a green asset to be able to put against a green bond. So in those cases, as we're seeing now with rate rises and the coming refinancing wall for high yield companies, that could be much more of an issue. You know, not everyone's an NL with huge amounts of cash to throw around.
Yeah. And there's another interesting debate about whether the, you know, if you try to work out, well, how much interest step up should a given company pay, you know, and sort of figure in the calibration of, you know, smaller, less credit worthy companies versus, you know, huge ones like a Unilever or somebody like that. It's actually quite difficult to work out a fair and right amount. And the Anthropocene Fixed Income Institute's method is to look at the net present value of all the total future coupons possible step-ups, which is a good way of dealing with the problem of the maturity differences. And then you discount that according to the credit quality of the issuer. So you relate it to credit quality in that way. But it's, you know, I think you know, the results from that can be a bit puzzling too sometimes.
And also, SLBs are so bespoke anyway with their KPIs, because each company has different things to approach, you know, to bring their carbon emissions down, that having then a bespoke approach to coupon step ups, I can just see investors getting quite grumpy about that.
Okay, well, we look forward to your next tome on the subject next week, John and Mike. I'm glad we're online only, because that would count for an awful lot of trees otherwise. Anna, sticking with corporate borrowing, you've written a very interesting story this week about an innovation in the syndicated loan market. And it involves using a portion of a company's revolving credit facility that's actually allowed to be drawn. Now, that probably makes no sense to a lot of people, what I've just said. So, first of all, what is a revolver?
Right. So the two key instruments that are usually used in syndicated credit are, you know, a revolving credit facility and a term loan. So a revolving credit facility is like a financial safety net or a pot of money that a company can dip into when it's needed. It's like having access to a line of credit with a bank where a company can borrow money up to a certain limit whenever they need it. And once they repay what they've borrowed, that amount becomes available to borrow again. So it's sort of like a continuous cycle or revolving door, basically. It offers flexibility because companies can use it whenever there's a need for some extra cash and pay it back when they're in a better position. And then a term loan is more like a traditional loan you might get for buying a house or a car, and it involves borrowing a specific amount of money for a set period, and you pay it back over time with regular payments. So unlike a revolving credit facility, once you repay a portion of a term loan, you can't borrow that amount again. So it's a one-time deal with fixed repayment plans.
So Anna, although you've described a revolving credit facility, but in reality, a lot of them are not used in that way, are they? They're
mostly undrawn. Yeah,
that's right. And there's an understanding that they never will be drawn.
Exactly. Yeah. So traditionally, they're never drawn. They're used for as a backup, basically, for emergency situations.
And what's the purpose of having a loan where it's never drawn?
Okay, so companies need to satisfy credit rating companies to show that they have extra liquidity if needed. But there's an understanding between banks and borrowers that it won't be drawn, because if it was, it would have to be priced differently.
Okay, so what's the innovation then that you've uncovered?
So it involves basically carving out a very specific tranche or portion of this traditional RCF to cater to a more immediate borrowing need. So it's essentially repurposing a part of that RCF that was traditionally left, as John said, completely undrawn.
And how do companies do this before, you know, if this is a new technique for sort of satisfying this need, what other methods have they got for that?
There's an ancillary facility, which is very similar to this, but while there are similarities to that, it's particularly in the segmentation of an RCF for specific purposes. This new trend focuses more on the functionality of the RCF itself, whereas ancillary facilities encompass an additional borrowing capability within a larger credit. So it's an additional, it's not part of a core RCF for a company.
What does that mean in terms of pricing the debt? If we say a term loan is the most expensive type of loan, and I presume a revolver is the cheapest, and then obviously an ancillary facility, I guess, will maybe fall somewhere between the two. But where does this sit in terms of how expensive it is for a company to use?
So it would have to be pre-agreed, but it would be, I think, an advantage both for the borrower and for the lender, because then the bank could price the drawn parts more, and the borrower could still take advantage of the relationship-driven undrawn part of it.
So Anna, why do you think this is happening now?
I think given, you know, the pandemic and the recent market instabilities in general, it have prompted companies to reconsider a bit how they use their RCFs. So they're seeing now the benefit of having more accessible funds beyond a pure emergency need, especially in volatile times where accessing credit lines can become critical.
And in general, I think there's been a bit more of a revival of actual bank lending to companies, hasn't there? I mean, I'm talking about big companies. Obviously, they lend to smaller ones, but there's, you know, for a long time, and really still, the orthodoxy is that companies don't use banks for borrowing. They borrow in the bond market or commercial paper, and the bank relationships are there for other things, notably these backup facilities, but also all kinds of other services. And that's sort of been jolted a bit, hasn't it, by the pandemic and other things.
Definitely. And I think bankers have been saying really that, especially for lower rated or unrated companies, so weaker corporates that face challenges issuing bonds during uncertain times, they might be then more be inclined to draw down on their loans. So it could be like a migration almost from the leveraged space where companies are facing funding constraints and rely more on their loan drawing.
I mean, let's talk about the pandemic era just for a little bit, because I think we need to make clear just what a big moment that was as far as revolving credit facilities were concerned, because all of a sudden companies were drawing left, right and center on their revolvers, weren't they? And you know, this previously unthinkable act, and yet they were a number were drawn. So do you think this is a direct response to that particular emergency?
I'm not sure. It's definitely a legacy from that as well. But I think given that the situation is here to stay with higher rates and general more uncertainty, I think companies will be more drawn to this kind of new structure.
What sort of conditions are required for a company to draw on this drawable part of its revolver? If a revolver is only for emergencies, but clearly it's not, you know, you can't just sort of dip in when you want to buy a new company jet because that's what the term loan's for. when do you get to use this part of the facility?
Yeah, it would depend on the type of company and the type of banks and their relationship, but it would have to come down to their specific borrowing needs at that particular time.
And presumably that would have to be pre-agreed between the bank and its lender. Sorry, the bank
exactly.
And the company.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay.
So how does this differ from having a revolving credit facility and having a drawdown fee on it, which is what most revolvers have?
It's a good question. Revolving credit facilities obviously are designed in their structure and you know, the way they're documented. They're designed to be drawn. That, you know, that if they couldn't be drawn, there'd be no point. And obviously, if the company draws down on the loan, it starts to pay interest on it. And it also pays a drawdown fee. But in the way that these loans are typically priced in the market, when they are just backup facilities, they're not priced as they would be if they were loans that were likely to be drawn, if you see what I mean. So I think the point about this is the bit of the RCF that is carved out is priced like a drawable RCF, and the rest of it is priced like an undrawable one.
What side is the driving force behind this? Is this the banks trying to, get their clients to take a more, realistic look at their borrowing? Or is this from the companies who are obviously very keen to sort of have access to credit but want to do it as cheaply as possible at a time when credit is probably getting much more expensive for them?
From what I've been hearing from bankers, it's more from the corporates, this need at the moment for this kind of new structure.
I'm not saying that that's not true, but whenever I've spoken to loans bankers, they're always desperate for money to be drawn. So I feel like it might
because that's how they make money, right?
Yeah, so, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, it is interesting that at the moment that the loan market's in a slump, isn't it? And Anna, you've been writing about this for our review of the year, which will be coming out a bit later. But you know, the market's had a shocking year, hasn't it?
Well, we've seen a 10-year low in European M&A. We've seen the lowest Q1 in the last 6 years or more. It was lower than 2022. So I think, it was overall very underwhelming. But it's starting to pick up now, and bankers are really happy about their new pipelines for the year.
But at a time like this, when banks are kind of have very little business to do, then you know it's a good time for companies to ask for different type of product, isn't it? Because the banks are sort of highly incentivized to accommodate them.
Exactly, yeah. And from what bankers have been saying, they see this as a positive change because, again, they could make more money from the drawable tranche of the RCF.
And I wonder as well, this is maybe if this becomes very popular, if there will be much of a knock on to the bond market, because if you're getting, if you can get 400 million quid from your banks, then you're not going to need to get 400 million quid from the bond market.
So to follow the development of any of the stories discussed in this podcast, or to stand a chance of attending GC Live on December the 13th, then do go to globalcapital.com and take out a trial or subscribe. Just cut out the middleman. In the meantime, thank you to John, Mike and Anna for joining me for this episode. And thank you most of all for listening. We'll be back with more from the capital markets next week. So thank you and goodbye.